Hello, Radioland. You are listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Darshiv. I am your host, Graham Stinnett. This is the radio and podcast program where we talk about archives and special collections, building research, building archives, resources that we have here at the University of Connecticut, and those who are generally curious. Today, we highlight a bit of an archival mission that this radio station itself began in 2023 to commemorate its 100th anniversary. I recorded an interview with Jonathan Kapeliewicz, who graduated in 2024. This interview was recorded this summer in 2025, and he talks a little bit about how he went about building the archive, making it digitally accessible, all the hands that it took to build this massive project. He wanted me to make sure that you knew there were many people he was unable to thank, and they will be listed in the show notes. Hopefully this gives you a bit more of an understanding of what it takes to sort of commemorate through community archival building, even though it's in something as robust as a university archives and a university institution that has a lot of resources to document this kind of stuff. Archives that are built by community members takes a lot of people to contribute to. So this is a shot at learning a little bit about how that work gets done and then how you can make those things digitally accessible. Let's see what Jonathan's got for us. Hope you enjoy. Welcome, Jonathan Kapeliewicz, class of 2024, graduate of the Digital Media and Design program at the University of Connecticut and former training director at WHUS. Thanks for joining me on the show, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
One of the sort of primary historical reflections that WHUS has been engaged in is this largely web archive project that you've been a big part of, 100 Years and Counting Anniversary Archive Project. Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about what this is?
Yeah, of course. So what this archive is, it's not just the website. It's also based on the Connecticut Digital Archive, where you can kind of publicly access all the recordings and materials that I've put together. What this archive is a compilation and celebration of the community that has formed WHUS for, you know, over 100 years at this point, like 102, 103 technically. And what the archive has is multimedia. So we have recordings dating all the way back to 1972, for example. We have one recording that's like 1963, 1964. We have video, mostly from John Tewitt's sports broadcasts. And we have a bunch of DJs' audio recordings ranging from the 90s to the 2020s.
Very cool. So 91.7 WHUS, as you kind of mentioned, celebrated its 100th anniversary. And this is a radio station made up of community members, students, of course, current and past, and that's a lot of different people involved in this radio station over 100 years. So, you know, what does it take for one group of current students or staff to get an anniversary project going to reflect on those past 100 years of a bunch of different undergraduate students and their experiences? You know, what made you guys go to such great lengths to try and make this anniversary important?
So basically, the idea for an anniversary project didn't start with me. It started with Grace McFadden. Grace McFadden was the news director and then progressed to the general manager. And in the summer before the academic year of 2023 to 2024, she proposed in a meeting, hey, WHUS's 100th anniversary is coming up. What should we do? And one of the ideas that popped up was a documentary of sorts. And I was like, hey, I like documentaries. I'm, you know, majoring in film and my senior project is coming up. Would you guys let me spearhead this thing? And they said, you know, sure. Yeah, you've been part of the station for, you know, for a while, kind of, you know, my 4 years there. And then the transition from documentary to website kind of just happened because as the executor of the archive, I'm pretty bad with killing my darlings, as they say in art, and I wanted to include nearly everything that I gathered, and a website was just the best way to do that. We went to such great lengths to make this history more accessible because it wasn't, essentially. The reason was, there's been thousands and thousands of DJs that have passed through WHUS, and a lot of them have gone on to make significant impacts on the world, and radio has played such a big role in their life, and WHUS has played a big role in my life too. I mean, it's why I want to do journalism now. And I figured WHUS means a lot to a lot of people. WHUS represents this kind of community spirit and alternative to traditional media. The station wanted to celebrate that. But when it came to me starting to do research, a lot of my frustration derived from archival materials itself being inaccessible. So, like, for example, when I was working with Betsy Pittman, an archivist at the University of Connecticut in the, UConn archives, the WHUS archive collections over there was like 3 to 4 boxes and about 38 tapes of audio from the women's radio collections that were unlabeled. And, you had to listen to them one by one on the archives tape player, which would have taken me forever. When DJs pass through the station, they usually take their memories and materials with them. And so a lot of the history gets scattered. And it's so scattered, right? Because there's no, people don't leave like contact information as a DJ, right? You know that they existed. You can read in pamphlets and program schedules and zines from the 1990s and the 1880s and the WHUS quarterly magazine that these people definitely existed and had an impact on the station, but there was absolutely like no way to get to them or contact them. So after scanning around 1,000 or so pages in the archive, working with Jonathan Trank and Betsy Pittman, I started combing through all the archival materials and kind of seeing like, okay, which names keep popping up? Okay, John Murphy, general manager from 1979. Oh, also general manager in 1989. 1999. Oh my God, he was there for a long time. How do I get a hold of him? And it took me like 2 months to get a hold of him. It was like six emails and three separate phone numbers. But he finally picked up and I was in the middle of class. I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I kind of like ditched class at that point just to talk to him. So yeah, a lot of the frustration came from the inaccessibility from the material. Now I will say that there is a DJ named Bob Nagel or Robert Nagel. He put together two Facebook groups, the WHUS Memories Mausoleum, and I forgot the name of the other one, and about three separate websites showcasing WHUS's archive. But the issue is these websites got taken down when the domain provider got bought out by a company named Vista, I believe. And so they announced suddenly that they were shutting down all the websites, all these like millions and millions of free websites that people. And the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive's snapshot machine that allows you to see previous web pages, didn't do a very good job of taking screenshots of this obscure WHUS website. I mean, this happened like December and January when I was already doing the archive, but it just kind of strengthened my drive to do it. But his archive was, it had a lot of personality, a lot of quotes, it helped a lot, but it wasn't what I was aiming for. Bob Nagel's archive was very, like I said, personality driven, lots of like cartoons and Photoshop pictures, like fun memories and tidbits. But what I was aiming for was a primarily historical record of WHUS, like very straightforward, very easily explainable, not just bits and pieces. It was also just an obsession with documentation. If I didn't know something, I just had to know it.
That's a great sort of summary of the distinction between like individuals making up what is the history of a more or less ephemeral project, a college radio station, right? Like nothing is recorded. Your shows are here today, gone tomorrow. There's no podcast that is the station, like there isn't an ongoing record of the playlists, et cetera. We do have Spinatron now, which is great. That helps us kind of get a snapshot of the data of what shows are playing what, but that's only in the last, handful of years, especially since the creation of the internet. So how then, as you'd mentioned, Bob Nagel having kind of a Facebook, personal anecdote
archive, maybe more so than the historical timeline of how things changed. How did you go about, I guess, casting that net to track down who maybe some of the record keepers, so to speak, are? You mentioned John Murphy. You know, thankfully the station has had these like positions for somebody to kind of keep the place floating, in addition to the student body that kind of comes over the course of several years at a time and then moves on. How did you go about trying to find like who the history keepers were?
My first instinct was, after scanning the archival pages and, you know, just having those documents, what I did was I combined it all into one PDF. Adobe Acrobat, by the way, does not like when your PDF is 1,000 pages and more than a gigabyte. But Adobe Acrobat has this OCR feature, or optical character recognition, right, where it converts all the PDFs into searchable text. So something that I did to save time, instead of, you know, scanning or skimming 1,000 pages, is WHUS had these quarterly or biannual magazines that were like full of, like, bursting with personality, you know, like Star Wars covers, or a Star Wars design cover, and lists of all the staff members who contributed to the station, and then all the shows, like, in program schedules for that year. And I figured that the record keepers were people who would stay there for 4 years or more. The special thing about WHUS is that sometime in the mid-1970s or late 1970s, they started allowing community members to join the station. I never actually looked into like what prompted this change, and I'm sure I could find it somewhere in the Daily Campus. That meant that people who weren't students could start contributing to that station. And this became really helpful, because now you have record keepers, or people who have been there for more than 4 years, right? Something that Susan Forbes Hansen said, who is a folk DJ, who is the longest running DJ on WHUS, she's been there since 1979, she's now been there for 46 years, is that, you know, the students cycle out every 4 years, but the DJs who stay there, they may not be bound by that cycle where you graduate, you find a job outside of Connecticut, and then you move. And, you know, this was like the 80s, 90s, 2000s. Remote shows were pretty hard to do, right? Because you had to record them at home, and then you had to send a cassette tape in or a CD in. And, you know, that's just a lot of work, especially like recording onto tapes. So basically, the people that kept appearing in these program guides post-1970s were the record keepers to me.
Maybe let's take a clip from some of the interviews that you have done. Can you talk first a little bit about the role of conducting interviews with people? How did you go about pitching to them your idea? And then how willing were people to talk to you about their history at WHUS?
So I messaged and contacted over about 80 former DJs and staff, including other institutions. So, you know, like collaborating with the African American Cultural Center and the Women's Center at UConn, to find people and kind of contribute materials to the archive, as well as contacting other archives in the state to see if they had any WHUS materials, like the Mansfield Library. I don't know, off chance they might have something, or the actual Connecticut State Archive. They had like one or two things that weren't very helpful. But when I call the DJs, you know, and I say, hey, my name is Jonathan, you know, they think I'm a spam number because I'm calling from like a 213 number, like Los Angeles. They're like, hello, who is this? And some of them are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, like, you know, they're working full time and it's the middle of the day, like 1 or 2 p.m. And I say, hey, my name is Jonathan. I'm the current training director at WHUS. We're doing an archive project because it's the 100th anniversary and I'm doing research. And is it okay if I talk to you a little bit about your experience? And you could kind of hear, you know how you can kind of hear smiles, right? You could kind of hear them smile over the phone, and this kind of like tension of, oh, this isn't a spam caller and he's not asking me for money. That tension dropped. The floodgates opened in a sense, because they'd spend 15 to 30 minutes talking with me on the phone just about like, oh my God, like, how's the station doing, et cetera. The response was super positive. I mean, again, these people are working in the middle of the day. They might be super busy, but they hear mentions of this place that had a really positive impact on them. Or, you know, it's just a fun, accepting place to hang around in. And, you know, they're perfectly willing to talk about it. I mean, you know, there's two or three people that didn't want to talk about it, and I didn't bother them beyond that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that reminds me of when I had seen in the 1970s period, which you've done a fantastic job of kind of breaking up the decades on the website. You can kind of scroll through. There's a lot of functionality. You've done a really good job in terms of building in the sort of interactivities, which represents the mass of multimedia that this archive really represents. But finding in the early 70s, some of the names of alumni that I know from my work with the Black student experience at UConn, such as shout out to alumni Glenn Cassis and Gary King, who formed the Black Media Collective at WHUS. That was really awesome to be able to see some of those newspaper clippings that you had found to contribute there. So let's play the first clip that we have. This is John Babina talking about some of these specifics around the formation and the sort of invisible rules around radio and WHUS having its need to carve out how much bandwidth it actually had.
Sometime in that time frame, the FCC decided to squeeze out the 10 watters because the 10 watters began populating the band at a pretty hefty rate. And the big boys complained that they had to protect this little rinky-dink thing with a large contour. So they were eating up the available space. When you put a station in, you can neither cause nor receive interference from each other. So if you had a station, I had to protect your contour, okay? Make sure that my contour was being protected without having to do anything. Otherwise, I would shrink my power. So that was basically what docket 14185.
So it's very possible that WHUS could have been forced to place on campus where nobody could hear them, for example.
Well, and even that, move them out of there. You could move, if you paid for the move, you could move a station away from your signal. Yes. This is all PKN. You know, we had no clue that that was coming. But Ralph already had a file prepared. So we went on the air and the clock started ticking. They had 30 days to protest. So by the time they woke up, we filed ahead of their buddy. They tried to get their buddy to take a chance.
Yeah.
And so we decided that we better tip off UConn and let them know what Ralph told us, that there's going to be an issue, you know. He filed it in such a way that they couldn't respond fast enough. Those organizations had to call a meeting, find out when the board of directors were going to be free. Then they had to do this and do that. We had the file done.
What can you tell us about that, Jonathan?
At the beginning of the clip, he talks about how kind of like these 10 watters would be effective. Just to give some context, WHUS was a super low power station. I think right now we're like 3,000 watts or more. Back then it was 10 watts. So the docket that he refers to basically would have allowed bigger stations to push lower power stations out of these geographical regions, because when a station broadcasts on a certain wavelength, as John mentioned, there can be interference with other radio stations on the same or similar frequencies. And then he mentions the filing at the end. Basically, government bureaucracy, right, kind of mandates like these waiting periods for files or, you know, like a certain response time. And someone he collaborated with when John Babina was at WKPN after he graduated from WHUS, called Ralph, named Ralph Winquist, helped file a bunch of documents simultaneously for a bunch of stations at once to kind of save them from this docket 14185 that would have kicked these low power college stations off their own campuses, essentially. The timeline's a little confusing because John Babina helped with docket 14185 after he graduated. He helped tip off UConn with a letter to Homer Babbage in 1967 to kind of, you know, alert him to the radio station being in danger.
Right. And that context is important. So he was a DJ from 1961 to 1965, you noted. And, you know, I don't want to talk too much about the current situation or status of radio, either optimistic or pessimistic. But, you know, thinking about the role of radio in places like 1967, where docket 14185 could be as drastic as, say, the creation of streaming services that you no longer need to listen to radio to get your musical, fix. How do you kind of think about current moment that you live in as a former student? What's your kind of perspective about those times and now?
Throughout my research, there was like a lot of transformational periods for WHUS itself, right? If we're just talking about the community. Basically today, if I was to zoom in and talk about WHUS, as a DJ, there was little interaction between the students and the community members. I mean, you know, a lot of the longtime community members are scattered throughout the program schedule. Like, for example, Susan Forbes Hansen is on Sunday nights, and Amy Ormolowski, who does bluegrass and has been doing Bluegrass Cafe on there for like, you know, more than two decades. You know, they're on the weekends, you know, not a lot of students are coming in on the weekends. So that was kind of one thing, was not that WHUS has lost its community spirit. Absolutely not. You know, we have over 100 DJs who, or, you know, I personally train over 80 DJs. I can't tell you the retention rate or how many of them got onto the shows. I feel like the danger to traditional radio mainly comes from the convenience and portability of something like Spotify or Apple Music. You know, you used to have to turn on the radio, or not, you didn't have to turn on the radio, but if you wanted to listen to music in the car, which is, you know, where people spend like a quarter of their lives or something, right? Commuting back and forth from work or whatnot, then they would have to turn on the radio. And, you know, these people who grew up with radio would listen to their parents' music in the car, you know, when they were being driven to school. And so those music tastes influenced down the road the radio programming. Not that Spotify can't do that, but the fact that, you know, I didn't grow up with Spotify playing in the backyard, but I grew up with like Queen and classic 80s rock playing on the radio meant that, you know, I had more of a familiarity, or my generation may have had more of a familiarity with, you know, the radio than, like, for example, I'm Gen Z, than like Gen Alpha or something. And, you know, reverse, you know, millennial grew up way more with radio, like talk shows and such. And, you know, that's kind of where you got your news aside from physical media. So I feel like radio is being threatened because, you know, when you have all the music you want in the palm of your hand, instead of leaving it up to chance, like, oh, if I turn on the radio and I don't like this, then I kind of like wasted my time. Then, you know, what's the point, right? That's where I feel the main danger to radio is these other forms of media allow you immediate access to whatever you want, whenever you want.
And it seems like you had also spoken with someone who was involved in the community relationships from WHUS as a student. Can you tell me a little bit about Chelsea Dodds before we hear a clip that you interviewed her about?
So Chelsea Dodds was a DJ there, I think from like 2007 to 2009, although I may be getting my dates wrong. Chelsea Dodds was first the production director and then the promotions director. And fun fact, what was cool is that she actually set up the first Mischief After Dark concert. I don't know if it was called Mischief After Dark at the time. It was called like Halloween Scare or something. I mean, the point is, it's one of our now major events of the year in Spring Fling, is two of the bigger live music events that WHOS still hosts. So I thought it was cool to speak to somebody who was at WHUS recently, who was there during transition to digital, and, you know, her experience may be a little more reflective of what WHUS is today versus talking to somebody who was there like in the 1970s.
Let's have a listen.
Well, yeah, challenges. What were some of the challenges that the station faced? Wow.
Well, there was the audit. That was the big one. So basically, after like my first semester there, I don't remember if this started in 2008 or 2009, but basically the radio station had been audited by, I don't know, higher up people on campus. I didn't totally understand what was happening when it first started happening. But they had said that because WHUS was a student fee funded organization, we could not have community members like in paid positions and voting on the board and voting at staff meetings and things like that. So we had to like rewrite the entire constitution. I was on the board when that was going on, so that was a lot. there are just like a lot of disagreements about the direction that the radio station should take in the future. And people were concerned that like community members would just get kicked out altogether and wouldn't be able to have radio shows. So it was just kind of like a hectic time and it was like really uncertain. I think it was just helpful hearing outside perspectives. Cause like I said, like we're college students, we're kids, right? Mm-hmm. And we're trying to run a radio station and we're doing all of these like very adult responsibilities at like 19 and 20 years old. So it's nice to have perspective and voices from people who have been around for a long time, who have more experience in these types of things. Like we used to do a lot more events out in the community as well when community members had a vote. Like we used to go table at like the first Thursdays in Willimantic during the summer. And after the audit, like we stopped doing as many things out in the community. We became more just like campus focused. And I miss that because one of the things, like we used to go to the Blues Fest in Hartford in the summers and table at that. So I feel like the audit made the station a little bit more insular. We were just kind of focused on promoting the station around the campus and getting students interested, but not necessarily like going out into the community anymore and trying to get the community involved or even like reach the community as listeners. So that was a really noticeable difference for me.
What do you miss about WHUS?
The camaraderie. I feel like everybody I met at the radio station was so passionate about either music or sports or public affairs or, you know, whatever their platform was that they wanted to showcase on their radio show. They were super passionate about it. And I feel like these days, so many people are apathetic about everything. And especially like I teach high school, teenagers are by nature apathetic about a lot of things. I really appreciated being around just so many other passionate people. You don't see that in like concentrated amounts like this in every part of your life. My senior year, I wanted to just like record music more. So I think it was on Tuesday nights. I had a poetry class that ended at 9 p.m. And then I walked over to the radio station afterwards and I reserved Studio B every Tuesday night from like 10 to midnight and told my friends, hey, every week I'm going to just record a song. You know, come and jam if you want. And learn a song. And sometimes it was a traditional folk song. And sometimes we would play a really folksy rendition of Float On by Modest Mouse. And we would record it. I don't know that was like super connected to anything else that I did at the station. It was just kind of a fun way to utilize Studio B and also just to bring people together and perform music. And I will say that in being a college radio DJ so far has shown up in every book that I've written.
Oh, that's so cool.
It is something that I'm like incorporating into my writing and characters that I'm writing as well. So that's fun.
So Chelsea obviously has a strong sort of memory component. I'm sure there are archival records that talk about this audit pretty specifically, but you know, her sort of reflection on the moment, this transition, why this matters, seems like an important part to telling the story of the history of WHUS. Did you find that this kind of memory return was useful in being able to chart this archive?
If you look at the archive now, like I've said before, it is a primarily historical document because it was very difficult, at least for somebody like me, to compile everything in a way that gives credit to the people that contributed to the station matter-of-factly. You know, I had to kind of rush to get it in for the senior project. The first thing I wanted to focus on was like, what happened? Here are documents that offer concrete proof of what happened. So, you know, I'm not just saying like this, and this happened, and DJs are saying ABC, whatever, right? You know, that's kind of the journalism background. Now, later, as I plan to do more and more of these interviews, and, you know, I have 12 like pre-interviews that I've already done in trying to get research for the station, but they were never recorded. I just took copious notes. Those memories are what contribute to the character of the station, I feel. So, for example, John Murphy told me that, you know, in his time, there's over 200 people on the staff. Here's a quote, I guess. It taught me to work for something higher than yourself. It taught you patience. It taught you sacrifice. And it taught you to develop your sense of humor because radio is always going to screw with you. So, you know, there was that. Beth Lazar, who was a member of the Women's Affairs Department, told me about how some trolls, or, you know, I mean, trolls is putting it lightly, would carve the word Nazi feminists into the women's affairs like cabinet, like the space they had for themselves for their music and news recordings. because, you know, this was the 80s and people weren't very accepting like that of that, even if they were, you know, college students. And also, like, I have no physical records of the Black, I think it's the Black Media Collective. You know, most of the DJs have passed away. You know, Glenn Classis didn't take anything with him. Gary King doesn't have, like, recordings or materials. The only things that are left are the physical remnants, which is those couple of newspapers I forgot the name of, you know, in the Yukon archives. And so that, you know, that's how I found all those names. You know, there were a lot of stories from DJs. Those are the emotional backing behind the archives. So, you know, show not tell, right? And I will eventually put them up. But the version of the archive that I was working on was, like I said, like primarily historically driven. And I plan to eventually add like DJ profiles, where with each interview, right, I do like a short write-up, and then, like, this is what happened, and this is what happened. If you want to hear another story, there was the Women's Radio Collective was being preempted on International Women's Day for, like, a UConn basketball game, and they were quite enraged at the prospect, because it was also International Women's Day that day, so they blockaded, some members blockaded themselves in the studio for, you know, couple, I think, like, I don't know the time. Or, like, what one of my favorite stories is Susan Forbes Hansen talked to Peggy Seeger, who's Pete Seeger's half sister. Susan talked about visiting her childhood home, and then Peggy wrote a song about Susan's story called "Everything Changes." You know, and that's a really cool, you know, that's a really cool kind of piece of history. But yeah, like, these memories lend character to what the station is.
Well, I think that's a perfect setup for our next clip. This is from Carol Babina, who was the first woman to be the station manager of WHUS.
I wasn't comfortable with public speaking. I figured it'd be a good opportunity to see what I could do. Actually, it was comfortable. It was welcoming in the fact that nothing was expected of me when I walked through the door. I went through the healing program, was able to get on air. There was not a lot of conflict. Basically, part of it was there was someone who preceded me that year, Al Robbins. He was station manager, and he dropped out of school. So I wound up moving up that year from...
So that was the typical progression, but it was always all male. And there was quietly a lot of sour grapes because a lot of the men thought they had a shot at it. They were disappointed, let's put it that way.
Yeah, we're still going through that today. It's evolving.
There's still a glass ceiling.
It basically, as a woman, you tend to know what's there and try to play around it.
Anything you want to contextualize about that clip, Jonathan?
Carol talks about the healing program. That's just the nickname that they used back then for the training program. And then the first part of the clip sets up why she joined WHUS. You know, not when she talks about there being little to no conflict, that's not necessarily representative of her reality as station manager, just, you know, her experience at WHUS in general when she walked through the door.
I think this is also just a really important piece to add into these historical, you know, markers that you have accounted for. And thinking through, you know, some of the DJs that you've mentioned are women who have been there longer than most other DJs, the role of the women's collective in the 70s and 80s, the amount of music that has been added to the music library within WHUS. There's these very specific niches that they helped build, and that really seems to be reflective of their investment, women's investment in WHUS over the last 50 years or more. So it's really cool to hear Carol talk about that experience.
I worked with Kathy Fisher, the Women's Center at UConn, and she pulled out some old scans and documents that they had of, like, playlists and correspondence between female DJs and such. And that was really interesting. And Betsy Pittman, God, she's so accommodating. At no cost to the station, added on in order to digitize those 38 cassettes that were in the Women's Radio Collective. And now you can listen to them, like, online with no restrictions. So I guess just as a footnote, like the last year, most of the executive board, so there's the exec board and the operations board, but most of the executive board were women. I think we've made some progress. Allie Urban, she was a metal/rock DJ at WHUS. She's still doing it. I think she works at the UConn Financial Center as we speak. But she has such an interesting story. She went from DJing to being a sports broadcaster at the same time. Her love of the music that she plays on the radio comes from metal and from her gaming buddies across the world, and just that kind of intercultural collaboration and community spirit, and also variety of things she's done at the station is, I think, a prime example of kind of the talent and spirit that WHUS fosters.
This all goes back to me loving heavy metal and a couple of my Finnish friends from gaming. So perkele is a Finnish word, P-R-K-E-L-E. It's the Finnish word for devil. So the internet abbreviation for that is P-R-K-L. And I'm like, oh, it's four letters. It's like WHUS. It's it sounds really cool, you know? I decided to make those my quote-unquote call letters for the show, and then Radio Metalli is just radio metal in Finnish. And then also it was neat because I had a lot of input from my friends too. Like my friend Sonia, she's from Serbia. She's one of my gaming friends. But I get input from people like her.
And they would literally help me plan some playlists sometimes. And I'd be like, all right, everybody, what are we going to do for today's set list? Like there's literally probably in Discord messages somewhere us planning playlists.
I remember one time, this was a couple of years ago, one of my friends from Croatia requested to play a song by a Croatian rock band, and they actually tuned into the show. They're like, this is so cool. Thanks for playing us on your show. And it was so, so neat. So it was neat that I could collaborate with people across the world, and just this show kind of broke borders, and I'd have friends from Finland, the friends from New Zealand, all over just listening.
Like you said, the gaming is borderless. I'm able to connect with a lot of different people, and it just opened my eyes to new stuff, and that was great too. But it's the most outstanding thing about the culture is the fact that anything goes. You want a heavy metal radio show? Sure, as long as you follow the rules, you could have your heavy metal radio show. And that's very meaningful, because especially when you get to commercial radio, but some other stations don't have the means, and some other stations could tell you F off, we don't want to listen to metal. You're going to drive listener ratings down with that garbage. So that was just always the alternative culture, which is something that was so cool. And then also associated with that, indie culture.
So you just mentioning all of the kinds of pots that you had to go to draw out not just the historical record, but also, folks who have memories of their time at WHUS and you doing recordings of it. You're talking about a lot of different collecting institutions, personal archives, which is part and parcel of the work of research, which we know a lot about at the archives. But in terms of building a community archive, which is very much what a lot of people are interested in. They want to know how they can not even necessarily bring in the materials and house them like an actual archives would, but just to be able to make an account of it and have it be accessible to the people who helped build that community. I think people are going to want to know, Jonathan, how you built this archive. So maybe could you tell us a little bit about the technical resources and platforms that you drew upon to make this archive work?
You start with, you identify names. Adobe Acrobat is really useful, only if you pay for it. But the station was willing to pay for it because it allows you to OCR, image to text. What's cool is it doesn't convert the image into a text file. It converts the image into a searchable kind of image, and you can copy and paste. The only issue with it was that a lot of these records were handwritten, and some people have doctor's handwriting and stuff. And when you copy paste it, it comes out as a bunch of jarbled symbols. But that's beside the point. So Adobe Acrobat OCR, Adobe Acrobat also has a feature if you pay for it called Building an Index. And what it does is it indexes all the text in the file. And that index, much like a computer indexing files, allows you to search through text way faster, because Adobe Acrobat, again, doesn't like it when your PDF is a gigabyte. This might be controversial, but I had no qualms about using AI. ChatGPT, Google Gemini, Claude, Whisper, APIs, I used it all. I didn't use it to write, But what was really helpful is I don't know how to code at all. So ChatGPT and Google Gemini's AI studio, which is completely free, and it has like a token context of 1 million. It's crazy. A ton of my research came from the daily campus archives from the 1920s to the 1990s. And Michael Hauser and Greg Colati showed me a way that if you add a specific keyword into the link of the actual page of the daily campus record, then you can download it. So, okay, what do I do? I asked ChatGPT, hey, can you build a bot, or essentially like a fake user almost, that searches the Connecticut Digital Archive, copies all the links on the page, puts all those links into a spreadsheet, and then modifies the links so that they're download links, and then opens those links individually. And so they all download on my computer and I don't have to do anything. And then after that, you know, I merge like 1,000 daily campus newspapers, and then I index them so I could easily search for mentions of like WHUS. And, you know, I could search up like WABL, which was like WHUS's like precursor. And then there was also like WCAC, and then the UCBS, which is the UConn Broadcasting System. And, you know, it these kind of like features just made it so much easier to do. You know, you don't have to know how to code. I mean, you do have to know how to type in stuff. And I also use Visual Studio Code as my code editor. You can also incorporate Google Gemini's AI code or GitHub Copilot, which kind of autocorrect codes, or you can like select the code in the window and say, hey, I'm trying to do this. There's a bunch of red lines highlighting mistakes. What's going on? You're the one who created this code. And it's like, oopsie. And then, you know, it fixes its own code. So that was kind of the AI part of it. I also created a scraper, which is like a bot that scrapes, kind of like collects links and such for the Internet Archive using their search API, archive.org. And, you know, it would search like WHUS with a bunch of operators after to exclude people who just spell like was wrong, or like WAS wrong, or sometimes in other languages besides American English that they spell like was or something like that way, like WHUS. So, you know, you have to exclude those, and then it would download those. And so now I have those in a hard drive. So if the Internet Archive ever goes down, it goes bye-bye, right? But I still have those records. Another thing you can use to really kind of help is the Wayback Machine. The Wayback Machine takes snapshots of websites and preserves them. And so we have versions of WHUS websites that are preserved going all the way back to 1998. And so those allowed me to see, much like the program guides, cross-reference for names of both shows and DJs that were quite popular back then. Yeah, so Otter is a AI-powered speech-to-text transcription service. You know, I had a three-hour interview with a DJ from the 1950s. I do not have the patience to listen to it, but I do have the patience to read it. And Otter allows you to upload files, and it'll transcribe it within like an hour or two. And that really helps, right? It also helps for pre-interviews. DJs gave their consent to interviews that were not to be used for anything but research. And Otter allowed me to read those interviews instead of like listening to them. Yeah, so WHUS.org is hosted on WordPress. And so Jason McMullen, the program coordinator, allowed me to use like archive.whus.org, which was also WordPress powered. And so that's of no cost to me, which I really appreciate. I understand that some people may not have that. So to use plugins and such to enhance, or if you want to like customize the CSS code or the JavaScript or the, you don't have to have Pro to customize the HTML, but if you want to have like custom CSS code, which can make the website look a little prettier, like you do have to buy like premium or business, right? And that's pretty annoying. If you want to self-host a WordPress website, there's also that. But that would have taken too much time. So I just asked Jason, like, hey, can I use like a WHUS.org domain, you know, so people could find WHUS archive? And, you know, they did. There's a space limit to how much you can upload on WordPress. Like the 3-hour interview was like half a terabyte because for some reason I decided to record in 4K. You know, nobody's watching this interview on a 4K television. So the space limits on that meant I had to be creative. If you look on the WordPress website, then you can also see, like, instead of a classic PDF embed, you might have a document where you can flip the pages, and it, or it looks like you're flipping the pages. So that's also a plugin. And, you know, the galleries that I used, that wasn't like a WordPress native feature. It was also a plugin. because it had to be like accessible to, I don't know who's reading this specifically, it's for the general public, but I have to imagine that if an old person wanted to read it, the way the website is set up, it's like, it's the text is centered, it's high margins, right? So it doesn't go all the way to the right. It looks okay on a phone, you know? So that's what I had to consider, is sometimes I go to my phone and I'd be like, wait, why does this image take up like half the website when on the computer it doesn't? And that was super frustrating. So WordPress is a really useful tool, and it can, you know, especially for something that's free.
Those are super helpful tips for any research and those looking to replicate the kind of work that you've been doing. So important to know that you have kind of the backup archive on that hard drive, but also the public facing gathering point is a WordPress site that is hosted by WHUS. Just from an archival standpoint, do you feel like the work of building this archive has maybe informed the current radio station's record-keeping practices or preservation plans going forward?
What I do know is their efforts in the last year, Katie Servast, the current and previous news director, at the time of us speaking, organized a trip to the archives to see WHUS's collection. I'm working with Jennifer Waits, who's a college radio historian and one of the managers of the Digital Library of Amateur Radio Communications, which is a sub-project of the Internet Archive, to kind of have WHUS records over there. Right now, I'm working with Michael Hauser at the Connecticut Digital Archive to put stuff up on the CTDA. In the WHUS monthly update, there's always a screenshot of like an archive page or like an archive document that says, hey, check out the archive at, you know, at archive.whus.org. And I know that Paige Ferreira, I don't know if she's a communications director now, but the communications director Paige Ferreira, an article on the WHUS archive website about Black media in honor of Black History Month. So there's that as well.
Sounds like you have become one of the record keepers going forward. So it's really heartening to know that you are a point for people to kind of bring their stories if they want to continue to share this information. So as we wind down, I know that you have also recorded, either through notes or other communications, some anecdotes that folks had wanted to share with you. Do you want to give us a sample of some of these before we sign off?
Jason McMullen, program coordinator, he was so, so helpful. He's been the program coordinator for the bigger part of a decade. I think even just a little more, and he's been involved with the station before then. He answered all my questions. Like, I just pop in. He has an open door policy, kind of. But, you know, I'd pop in, be like, hey, Jason, do you have a minute to talk? And it turned into 20 minutes. So what he says is, Jonathan's efforts to document and preserve the history of WHUS radio is incredibly meaningful because WHUS has positively impacted my life and the life of thousands of friends and comrades over the years. This radio station is special because of the people who come to the community they create and the creativity and insights they broadcast. It's just a little college station at a state university in the Northeast, but something special has been happening here for decades, and I'm so glad of the stories and creations of WHUS people are being preserved and made available. So that's Jason McMullen's quote. And then the other quote that I have is from Sophia Curran, who was the general manager last year, but at the time she was helping me, she was the events coordinator. And what she did more was like ideating, brainstorming, like emotional support. You know, when I was going through a tough time with the archive, she kind of like helped me get back on track a lot. So what she says is that WHUS has meant so much to so many people over its 100-year history. Our station has played every single type of music from every single type of person. There's so much beauty in a community-based environment. The history of WHUS is important to document because our community is for everyone and our music is for everyone.
Those are great. And I can imagine you have had many hands helping you along the way. In addition, do you want to do some shout-outs before we sign off?
Yeah, sure. So, the people I'd like to thank, first is Catherine Massoud, or Professor Catherine Massoud, Digital Media and Design Department. She was my senior project advisor, and she was so, so helpful in keeping me on track. I spent months and months on research when honestly I didn't have. She was there for me at every step of the way. Alan Herrick, who at the end of the semester, for like free of charge, he's like a professional web designer, helped me put together that archive. Jason McMullen, of course, I've already mentioned that he's done so much for me. You know, he fostered my growth throughout the 4 years that I've been at WHUS, whether I was doing news or training or the archive. He was just always there. He was giving me constructive feedback about like characters and personality wise me and you know, the other stuff at the station. Sophia Curran, I've already mentioned. Jill Brown, who is the current GM and was the previous inventory manager, she did a lot of research for me. She sat down for me when Chelsea Dodds came over. We spoke for like 2.5 hours. It was crazy. Henry Stanton, he was the GM. He helped me out a lot. As a general manager, he was also kind of part of the, you know, I'd go to him when I needed something for the archive, you know, copyright issues, et cetera. He even drove down with me. He had a, what was it, like tendonitis, and, you know, he could barely like use his hand, and he drove me all the way to Rhode Island for this 3.5 hour interview with the DJ from the 50th. Patrick Boots, he was also kind of like, you know, he helped me do research. He helped scan. Allie Urban was so helpful. She categorized all her shows by folder. She gave me multiple interviews. Susan Forbes Hansen, of course, right? 45 years. She was speaking to me while she was doing the show, like during her breaks. Shanice Rule, she was the comms director. She like, you know, transported me. Like we went to a niche radio museum, you know, just to, cause I was like, how does the radio work in the 1920s and 1930s? She was like, you know, let's go. Alicia McKenzie, or I think Dr. McKenzie of the African American Cultural Center, Kathy Fisher of the Women's Center, John Murphy, of course, GM, gave me so much material. Right now for the Connecticut Digital Archive, he's helping me categorize his own scans because I wasn't thoughtful enough to take notes when he gave them to me. So he's doing that. And then, of course, the Yukon Archives and Special Collections, Jonathan Trink and Betsy Bittman for the painstaking collaboration and allowing me to scan their extensive archives, as well as Michael Hauser and Greg Colati of the Connecticut Digital Archive for helping me preserve these memories, as well as Jennifer Waits of the Internet Archive. You know, of course, all the other DJs who sent me materials and spoke to me, right? Like Brian Albright, Andy Heidel, Chris Sampson, Melinda Pierce of the Women's Radio Collective, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of people to thank, and I don't have time to thank them all, but I am really appreciative of their help. And, you know, I couldn't have done this without them.
Really helpful to hear all of the hands that it took to get you both to this place academically, of course, but also the technical and the historical reminders that the community radio station literally was built by a community, and some of those people you have gotten to speak to over the last couple of years is truly part of the collaborative effort to make this archive. Thanks, Jonathan, so much for being on the program, and I look forward to seeing how the archive continues to develop.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the chance to speak about this.
I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the Archives and Special Collections, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.